posing a big hike in the city's property tax, something that many homeowners were less than enthusiastic about. Starting in the low-income and working-class neighborhoods, I knocked on as many doors as possible. And what an extraordinary experience that was. Over the years, during my statewide campaigns and later, of course, during the presidential race, my campaigns have spent a great deal of money on TV and radio ads, many, many millions of dollars. I have never forgotten, however, that the most important political work that can be done is making door-to-door contact, speaking directly to your constituents, and answering their questions. We need a lot more grassroots politics in America. The big breakthrough for us came late in the campaign when we won the endorsement of the Burlington Patrolmen's Association. They backed us because I promised to listen to the concerns of cops on the beat and to open serious negotiations with their union. In supporting my candidacy, the police union and its leader, Joe Crapo, showed enormous courage. If I lost, which most people expected, they would be even deeper in the doghouse with the incumbent mayor. There was no question that the endorsement of the police union was extremely important. If a leftist populist, a former opponent of the war in Vietnam, could win the support of the conservative men in blue, we were on our way. Further, I did well in a much-publicized mayoral debate, sponsored by neighborhood organizations and organized by my soon-to-be co-workers, Phil Fermonti and Jane Driscoll, now Sanders. Election Day, March 3, 1981, was a day I will never forget. My political gut was telling me one of two things would happen. Most likely, as the media was predicting, we would once again go down in flames. After all, I had never received more than 6% in an election. Why would this campaign be any different? On the other hand, the response that we were receiving all over the city was very positive. Maybe, just maybe, we could win a major victory. The one thing I never anticipated is exactly what happened. The election results were extremely close. We won the working class wards in the city by 2-1. We lost in the wealthier neighborhoods. By the time the last ballot was counted, I had won by 14 votes. So stunning was the upset that 9 years later, the state's largest newspaper would still be referring to it as the story of the decade. 2 weeks after the election, and after we obtained a court order to move the ballots away from City Hall to the safekeeping of the state judiciary, the recount was completed. While my margin dropped from 14 to 10 votes, I was elected mayor of Burlington. I was now the only mayor in the country to have bucked the two-party system, the only socialist mayor in America. I was inaugurated in April 1981 before a very large crowd at City Hall. Later, a reporter asked for a copy of the speech I had given, and I handed her my pages of scribbled notes on a yellow legal pad. I was pleased with the speech I had delivered, injecting local issues into the broader national and international context. One of the immediate crises I faced was purchasing clothing suitable for a mayor. At the time, I didn't own a suit, just one or two corduroy sports jackets and a few ties. It wasn't my intention to become the best-dressed mayor in America or even to wear a tie all that often. I thought, however, that a little sprucing up wouldn't hurt. Overnight, my wardrobe doubled in size. The great challenge that we faced in 1981 was how we would implement our ambitious campaign promises and how we would transform city government. How would we democratize Burlington politics and open the government to all people, regardless of their income? How would we break our dependency on the regressive property tax, yet raise the revenue we needed to implement our programs? How would we protect the environment and stop unnecessary road construction, at the same time creating a people-oriented waterfront? How would we bring municipal services to the long-ignored lower-income and working-class neighborhoods? How would we bring women into a city government long dominated by an old boys' network? How would we reach out to the young people of the city as well as to the seniors? How would we treat city employees fairly, not only through decent wages and working conditions, but by involving them more in the decision-making of their departments? How would we improve the arts in Burlington and make cultural activities available to all people, regardless of their income? Those were a few of the challenges we faced as we took office. In order to bring new people and new ideas into city government, we created a number of mayor's councils on youth, the arts, women, senior citizens, health care, and tax reform, among other areas of concern. The early days of my administration were exhilarating but very tense. In fact, there was a civil war taking place in Burlington city government. Conservative Democrats had controlled Burlington city government for decades, and with their Republican allies were going to do everything possible not to give up their power. The Board of Aldermen, as it was then called, consisted of 8 Democrats, 3 Republicans, and 2 allies of mine. At my first official meeting as mayor, the Board of Aldermen fired my secretary, the only person I'd been able to hire. They claimed I hadn't hired her in the proper way. It was their way of reminding me who had the power. 2 months later, on the day that the mayor formally announced his choices for positions in the administration, the board rejected all of my appointees. The situation was absurd. I was expected to run the city government with the administrative leaders of the guy I had just defeated in a bitter election, as well as with a group of people who vigorously opposed me and my agenda. The Democrats' strategy was not complicated. They would tie my hands, make it impossible for me to accomplish anything, then win back the mayor's office by claiming that I had been ineffective. And what was our strategy in response? First, we were going to do everything that a mayor could possibly do without the support of the Board of Aldermen. Second, we were going to expose the local Democrats and Republicans for what they were, obstructionists and political hacks who had very few positive ideas. Last and most important, we were going to build a third party in the city and defeat them in the next election. Over the following months, we started a successful Little League program in a low-income neighborhood, a program that still exists today. We began what was to become a citywide tree planting program that transformed block after block in Burlington and eventually won us national recognition for city beautification. We began a very popular free summer concert series that drew thousands of people to a beautiful waterfront park where they listened to music and watched the sunset over Lake Champlain. We did all this and more, despite opposition from the Board of Aldermen, by scratching together a few bucks here and a few bucks there. As the year progressed, it became clear that the only way we could fully implement our agenda for the city was by electing a majority of progressives to the Board of Aldermen, which meant the creation of a new political entity. In the beginning, we called it the Independent Coalition. Later, it was renamed the Progressive Coalition. Over several months, we put together a very impressive slate of candidates who were prepared to challenge Democrats and Republicans in every one of the city's 6 wards. This coalition, formed in 1982, became the foundation for progressive third-party politics in Vermont. Not only has it continued in Burlington to this day, electing 2 progressive mayors after me, it has spread statewide. Today, 3 out of 30 members of the Vermont State Senate are progressives, as are 7 members of the Vermont House. The Vermont Progressive Party is one of the most successful and long-standing third parties in America. Our municipal elections are in early March, and it gets very cold in Vermont in the winter. Frankly, it was not always fun knocking on doors in January and February when the temperature was below zero, but that's what we all did. I went out with our candidates as often as possible. The themes of the campaign were clear. First, our candidates were running on our progressive platform. Second, we were taking on Democrats and Republicans who were obstructing the mayor from doing his job. Voter turnout for the aldermanic elections hit an all-time high in a city that now had an enormous amount of political energy. On election night, we won 3 of the 6 wards that we were contesting, and we drove a Republican and a Democrat into runoff elections in the other 2 wards. Not surprisingly, in the runoff election, the Democrats and Republicans worked together, and we failed to win in those wards. Nevertheless, that campaign was an enormous success. Instead of having just two members on the Board of Aldermen, we now had five. This gave us veto power. We could block any Democratic-Republican initiative. They had no other choice but to work with us. There was a new balance of power in city government, and we could go forward. And forward we went. I have to say our accomplishments over the years were significant. In fact, several books have been written about them. I was proud to have been named one of the best mayors in America by U.S. News and World Report, and many cities around the country emulated the programs we developed. We became the first municipality in Vermont to develop progressive alternatives to the property tax. Every day, people flocked to the city in order to work, play, and enjoy our active nightlife. It was right that they contribute to the city services they enjoyed. We established the first municipal meals and rooms tax in the state. After a court battle, the utilities were forced to pay for the damage done when they tore up our streets for utility work. We needed new funding to build a strong infrastructure. Following a heated battle with the local cable TV company and an effort on our part to create a municipally owned system, we managed to get substantial revenue from the company and reduce rates for seniors and residents of low-income housing. We addressed the inequities in the city's relationship to our large tax-exempt institutions. We managed to get a substantial increase in payments in lieu of taxes from the University of Vermont and the Fletcher Allen Hospital for police and fire services. The hospital also began to play a more active role in the health care needs of people in our lower-income communities. We also developed a plan that brought in more revenue from our municipally owned airport in South Burlington. It turned out that our expansion of cultural activities was extremely popular. We started a jazz festival, a blues festival, a reggae festival, and a country music festival. We also started a first night celebration on December 31st that was attended by thousands of people who enjoyed a wide variety of cultural activities in downtown Burlington. Most of these events continue today. One of my favorite evenings was a poetry reading in Burlington City Hall where Allen Ginsberg, the brilliant poet of the Beat Generation, joined Burlington school kids in reading poetry. Noam Chomsky, perhaps the best-known progressive writer in America, spoke to a full house in City Hall. Studs Terkel, the great writer, visited us during a workers' rights celebration. I spoke on a panel along with Abby Hoffman and Dave Dellinger, two heroes of the 60s, and what turned out to be a very amusing evening. Ella Fitzgerald, the iconic singer, performed at a jazz festival. Burlington was becoming one of the most exciting small cities in the country. In the midst of all those new activities, we never forgot about the traditional responsibilities of city government. I kept my word to the city's police officers, expanded and improved the police department, and raised pay. We upgraded the very expensive and life-saving trucks and apparatus used by the fire department. We created a much more efficient public works department and implemented a major street and sidewalk repaving program. We purchased an entirely new fleet of snow removal vehicles and created a more effective snow removal plan. In Vermont, snow removal is serious business. We instituted the largest environmental improvement program in the state's history, a $52 million city-state federal project to rebuild our sewer system, upgrade our wastewater plants, and stop the pollution of Lake Champlain. We shut down the environmentally unsound landfill and killed a proposed trash-burning plant that would have been both an environmental and fiscal catastrophe. We also passed a bond for our municipally owned electric department to start us on the path of energy efficiency. After a whole lot of debate, we initiated an extensive waterfront beautification plan. The plan for expensive condos on the waterfront was replaced with a people-oriented waterfront consisting of public parks, a 9-mile bike path, and a community boathouse. Today, Burlington's is one of the most beautiful and well-utilized waterfronts in the country. We also developed some of the most innovative affordable housing concepts in the country. Against opposition from some members of the local real estate industry, we became the first city in America to fund community land trust housing. Through the Burlington Community Land Trust, working class people were able to purchase their own homes at a lower cost than was available on the commercial market. The housing remains affordable in perpetuity because the owners must agree not to resell the property at market rates, accepting only a reasonable and limited return on their investment. This community land trust concept has not only spread all across our country, but it has been adopted in other nations as well. The United Nations acknowledged the Burlington Community Land Trust as one of the most creative approaches to affordable housing in the world. With the help of my soon-to-be wife, Jane Amira Driscoll, who became head of our youth office, we paid a lot of attention to children and young people. After a major fight with a reluctant school department, we established after-school programs across the city. Kids needed a place to play and do homework after school, and working parents needed to know that their kids were safe. Today, 30 years later, the program is a vital part of the city's educational system. We also established a teen center known as 242 Main, which was, within limits, run by the young people themselves. In fact, some of them helped build and design it. No drugs, no smoking, no alcohol. Just the loudest music imaginable. Kids from throughout the city and other towns flocked to 242 Main because it allowed them to be themselves. Over the years, we heard from many people about how important that center was in their young lives. My administration fought for a universal child care program. The opposition was too strong, and we didn't succeed. We did, however, start the largest child care center in the city. It is still in existence today. Jane's work with the children and teenagers of Burlington was incredibly innovative and effective. From after-school programs to a teen center to a teen newspaper and a TV show to a youth theater program to the creation of a little league in a low-income neighborhood to a child care center, Jane helped transform the city's relationship to our young people. And for us, it was the beginning of a working relationship that has now gone on for 35 years. Our city government was not just about bricks and mortar, waterfront development, and snow removal. We were also about baseball. In 1983, working with a citizens committee, we managed to bring minor league baseball back to Burlington after a hiatus of 30 years. The AA team, affiliated with the Cincinnati Reds, was an enormous success both financially and on the field. The team won 3 straight Eastern League championships and was one of the great minor league teams of their time. At least 6 ballplayers on the Vermont Reds eventually became major leaguers. How many cities of 40,000, which is the population of Burlington, have a foreign policy? Well, we did. During my tenure as mayor, we made the point that excessive spending on the military and unnecessary wars meant fewer resources to address the needs of ordinary people. Somewhere in the Reagan Library, or wherever these things are kept, there is a letter from the mayor of Burlington opposing the U.S. funding of Contras in Nicaragua. The letter stated, quote, "Stop the war against the people of Nicaragua. Use our tax dollars to feed the hungry and house the homeless. Stop killing the innocent people of Nicaragua," end quote. As mayor of Burlington, I helped establish 2 sister city programs. One was with the town of Puerto Cabezas in Nicaragua. The other was with the city of Yaroslavl in what was then the Soviet Union. Both programs continue today. In 1983, the Burlington Free Press, the city's daily newspaper and voice of the business community, urged the Democratic and Republican parties to join forces around one candidate in order to defeat my reelection bid. That didn't happen. I won reelection with 52% of the vote. The Democratic candidate, Judith Stephanie, got 31%, while the Republican candidate, Jim Gilson, won 17%. Interestingly, during my tenure as mayor, voter turnout soared. In 1979, before the progressive movement was active in Burlington, 7,000 people voted in the mayoral election. In 1981, when I was first elected, participation went up to 9,300. In 1983, when I was reelected mayor, 13,320 people voted, almost twice as many as in 1979. The citizens of Burlington had seen a local government working in their interests, and they came out in large numbers to support it. In the low-income and working-class wards, I won close to 70% of the vote in a 3-way race, and our aldermanic candidates there won landslide victories as well. In 1987, the Democrats and Republicans of the city took the advice that the Burlington Free Press had offered 4 years before. They combined their parties for the mayoral campaign and rallied around one candidate, a Democrat on the city council. Needless to say, taking on the combined parties wasn't easy, but we ended up winning that election 54% to 46%. In July 2016, the New York Times described Burlington as a city, quote, with breakthrough technology now spawning a wave of technology pioneers, end of quote. Burlington has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country and a strong public school system. It is extremely environmentally conscious. It has been aggressive in energy efficiency and now receives all of its energy from sustainable sources. In recent years, Burlington has welcomed immigrants from around the world and has been a national leader in the struggle for LGBT rights. I am proud to live in Burlington, Vermont, as you may have noticed. In 1986, during my third term as mayor, I ran for governor of Vermont and, in a three-way race, received 14% of the vote. This was a tough campaign. I was running against a liberal incumbent, Madeline Cunin, the first woman governor in the history of the state of Vermont. That campaign differentiated what it meant to be a quote-unquote liberal as opposed to a quote-unquote progressive. Cunin and I mostly agreed on social issues. Our differences were on economic ones, where I stood more strongly with the workers of Vermont. 2 years later, in 1988, I ran for Vermont's lone seat in the U.S. Congress. When that campaign began, I was considered to be the quote-unquote spoiler, someone who would take away votes from the Democrat and allow the Republican to win. It turned out differently. The Republican, Lieutenant Governor Peter Smith, did win with 41% of the vote, but I came in second with 38%, while the Democrat was far behind at 19%. I felt very good about the campaign I had run. I focused on important issues facing our country and had a much stronger presence in the southern part of the state, where I was not particularly well known, than had been the case in 1986. Going to Washington. 2 years later, in 1990, I became the first congressman in 40 years to be elected to the United States Congress from outside the two-party system. I defeated Congressman Smith by 16 points. 2 years before, Smith and I had run an issue-oriented, cordial campaign. This time was different. Smith apparently listened to some Washington consultants and ran a very negative campaign. There was one TV ad in which he compared me to Fidel Castro. It didn't work. The people of Vermont disliked negative ads, and his strategy backfired. The vote for the Democratic candidate was negligible. On election night, there was a huge celebration in Burlington. We were on our way to Washington. My first weeks in Congress were rather difficult and dramatic. The Democratic leadership didn't know what to do with the first independent elected to the House in 40 years. Despite earlier assurances that I would be welcomed into the House Democratic Caucus, that turned out not to be the case. Some conservative Democratic members balked, and I found myself in no man's land, neither in nor out of the caucus. Also, it was unclear what committee assignments I would have and where I would physically sit in the committees. Finally, after several painful weeks, an agreement was worked out. I was accepted into the Democratic caucus and got assigned to the House Banking Committee and the House Government Operations Committee, where I served under the very able leadership of Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez and John Conyers. On top of all the caucus nonsense I was experiencing during my first weeks in Congress, there was a more important reality. The United States was about to go to war. President George H.W. Bush was determined to send in our military to drive the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, which Saddam Hussein had invaded in August 1990. Almost all Republicans supported the war effort, as did a number of Democrats. I didn't. I had campaigned against going to war and did everything I could to stop it. I feared not only the immediate impact of the war in terms of the death and destruction it would bring, but what it portended for the future. Would war and more wars be the norm in solving international conflicts in the future? The entire world was united against a small country with a weak army. Surely, I reasoned, there must be a way other than war to achieve our goals and get Iraq out of Kuwait. On January 15, 1991, in one of my first speeches in Congress, this is what I said on the floor of the House.
Mr. Speaker, let me begin by saying that I think we all agree in this body and throughout this country and throughout virtually the entire world that Saddam Hussein is an evil person, and what he has done in Kuwait has been illegal, immoral, and brutal. It seems to me, however, that the challenge of our time is not simply to begin a war which will result in the deaths of tens and tens of thousands of people, young Americans, innocent women and children in Iraq, but the real challenge of our time is to see how you can stop aggression, how you can stop evil in a new way, in a nonviolent way. And if ever there has been a time in the history of the world when the entire world is united against one small country, this is that time. And it seems to me a terrible failing and very ominous for the future if we cannot resolve this crisis, if we cannot defeat Saddam Hussein in a nonviolent way. If we are not successful now, then I think all that this world has to look forward to in the future for our children is war and more war and more war.
In March 2003, buoyed by the quote-unquote success of the first Gulf War, President George W. Bush decided to invade Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein. Once again, as was the case in the first Gulf War, virtually all Republicans supported the war, as did a number of Democrats. The results: hundreds of thousands dead, millions displaced from their homes, massive instability in the region, and the growth of a number of fanatical terrorist organizations that continue to threaten the lives and safety of the American people and our allies. In 2016, the fighting continues. During my first year in Congress, I managed with a few other members to form the House Progressive Caucus, which today is one of the largest caucuses in Congress. The Progressive Caucus, currently led by Congressman Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva, has been in the vanguard in the fight for economic and social justice since its inception. Over the years as a member of the House, I played an active role in fighting the deregulation of Wall Street and opposing corporate welfare and an unfair tax system. I was also on the picket lines against disastrous trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and Permanent Normal Trade Relations, PNTR, with China. In my 16 years in Congress, I am proud to have compiled one of the strongest voting records there on behalf of workers' rights, seniors, women, children, the LGBT community, and the environment. One of my longtime fights has been against the greed of the pharmaceutical industry, which charges our people, by far, the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. In 1999, I became the first member of Congress to take constituents over the Canadian border to purchase low-cost prescription drugs. With tears in their eyes, working-class women struggling against breast cancer were able to purchase the same brand-name medicine they were using in Vermont for one-tenth of the price in Montreal. After my trip, many other members of Congress did the same thing. Over the years, millions of Americans have purchased affordable prescription drugs in Canada. In 2006, Republican Senator Jim Jeffords retired. On the day he made his announcement, I issued a public statement that I intended to run for his seat. I was very grateful that on that day, Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid, whom I had never met, announced that he was supporting me. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York also endorsed me. Their endorsements helped tamp down possible Democratic opposition in Vermont. During that campaign, a young senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, came to Vermont to campaign for me. We had hoped to fill the 1,500-seat chapel at the University of Vermont. Instead, about 3,000 people showed up. Because of the resulting crunch, Obama and I had to go out onto the steps of the chapel and give impromptu speeches there before we returned inside. My Republican opponent in the race for the Senate seat was the wealthiest person in the state, a businessman named Richie Tarrant. This was a rather extraordinary campaign for Vermont. Not only was it extremely negative, with ad after ad portraying me as an enemy of humanity, but it was also very expensive. Tarrant spent more money per vote in 2006 than any Senate candidate had in American history up to that point. His money ended up not mattering very much. I defeated him with a vote of 65-32%. I was now on my way to the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate is a very, very different place from the House of Representatives, where I spent 16 years as Vermont's lone congressman. There are 435 members in the House, and most members serve, as I had, on just two large committees. During my years in the House, I was a member of the House Banking Committee, later renamed the House Financial Services Committee. I was also a member of the Government Operations Committee, later renamed the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Both panels had more than 50 members. The U.S. Senate has only 100 members, and by definition, each member plays a larger policy role than a member of the House. When I was elected in 2006, the Democrats, by two votes, took control of the U.S. Senate. Senator Harry Reid, the new majority leader, was extremely kind to me and appointing me to most of the committees I wanted. I had requested of Senator Ted Kennedy, the longtime leader of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the opportunity to serve with him on that very important committee. I was very appreciative that he consented. My interest in environmental issues was longstanding, and I was fortunate to be appointed to the two major environmental committees, the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources and the Committee on Environment and Public Works. The Environment Committee was led by an old friend of mine from California, Barbara Boxer. As a strong advocate for veterans, I was also delighted to be appointed to the U.S. Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, as well as to the Budget Committee, which gave me an important say in the development of national priorities. As a member of the Senate, I am proud to have passed some major legislation. Majority Leader Harry Reid, Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, and I succeeded in putting $11 billion into community health centers throughout the country as part of the Affordable Care Act. This enabled some 6 million more Americans, regardless of their income, to access primary health care, dental care, low-cost prescription drugs, and mental health counseling. We also substantially increased funding for the National Health Service Corps, which brought thousands of doctors, dentists, and nurses into medically underserved areas throughout the country. In Vermont, almost 25% of our people now receive their primary health care through community health centers, a higher percentage than in any other state. I've always believed that within a broken and dysfunctional health care system, the lack of primary care for so many is one of our most serious problems. People should be able to get to a doctor or dentist when they need to. We have made some progress in that area. More needs to be done. As part of the 2009 stimulus package, working with Senator Bob Menendez in New Jersey, we passed funding for the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program. This legislation, strongly supported by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, has been one of the government's major efforts to combat climate change. It provided billions of dollars for communities all across the country to move toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. In Vermont, a number of schools throughout the state were able to use that money to place solar panels on their rooftops. This not only cut carbon emissions, but saved schools money on their electric bills. As a staunch defender of Social Security, I helped lead the fight against Republicans and some Democrats who wanted to cut this program, which is life and death for so many seniors and people with disabilities. Working with seniors organizations, I helped create the Defending Social Security Caucus. The other senators in the caucus and I took on the Bowles-Simpson Commission, billionaire Pete Peterson and his organization, and a whole lot of other groups that wanted to cut Social Security in one way or another. In the end, barely, we managed to prevail, and Social Security was not touched. Times are changing. I am proud that much of the discussion with regard to Social Security now deals with how we can expand the program, not cut it. More and more members of Congress understand that seniors cannot live on $11,000 or $12,000 a year, and that we need to lift the cap on taxable income and raise benefits. In 2013, I became chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. In that capacity, I work closely with virtually all of the veterans organizations in developing comprehensive legislation that significantly addresses the problems facing the men and women who put their lives on the line to defend our country. I was tired of hearing about how much we all loved and respected veterans. It was time to do something. The legislation I introduced was, according to the veterans organizations, the most comprehensive piece of legislation offered for them in many decades. Sadly, despite the strong support of the American Legion, the veterans of foreign wars, the disabled American veterans, and other organizations, my legislation only received 56 votes on the floor of the Senate. All the Democrats, but only two Republicans. We needed 60 votes. It turned out that Republicans loved veterans very much, except when it came to funding their needs. If I was to be successful in winning important veterans legislation, I would have to go back to the drawing board and bring additional Republicans on board. My unlikely ally in that effort was Senator John McCain of Arizona. John and I and our staff spent hours yelling at each other over the provisions in the bill, but finally reached a $15 billion compromise that significantly improved veterans' health care. It also provided some new benefits for veterans. The bill carried in the Senate with an almost unanimous vote and became law when President Obama signed it in a ceremony with hundreds of veterans in attendance. I've always had a good relationship with President Obama. He is incredibly smart, and I admire him greatly for his focus, discipline, and determination. But we have had our strong disagreements. Obama has continued U.S. support for unfettered free trade agreements, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think those trade policies have been a disaster for American workers and have opposed all of them. On December 10, 2010, I took the floor of the United States Senate in opposition to another one of Obama's policies, the extension of some of Bush's tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans. I began that speech at 10:30 a.m. It ended 8.5 hours later. It was the longest filibuster on the Senate floor in many years. I did the filibuster to call attention to and oppose a very bad tax agreement between President Obama and the Republican leadership at a time of massive wealth and income inequality and a huge national debt. It was absurd that hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks would continue going to millionaires and billionaires. This speech received a great deal of attention, especially online. The Senate website crashed because of the huge number of people trying to watch it. C-SPAN 2 also had an exceptional viewing audience. According to the New York Times, my speech was the most tweeted event in the world that day. There were front-page stories in newspapers around the country, and the speech was covered widely in the international media. In one day, the number of people who signed up as quote-unquote friends on my Facebook page doubled the previous total. Visits to my website went sky high. Some journalists even claimed that Obama held an unscheduled, impromptu press conference that day with former President Bill Clinton, who defended the tax deal, in order to divert media attention away from what I was doing on the Senate floor. A few months later, Nation Books published the entire speech as a book. My ideas were beginning to generate more interest. Chapter 3, Thinking About Running. The writer, Jonathan Tassini, did an interview with me for Playboy magazine that was published in October 2013. He is a good writer, and the interview went well. At the end of our discussion, Jonathan said, "Many of your hardcore supporters are urging you to run for president in 2016. Are you considering it?" And then he followed up by asking, "Are you absolutely ruling out running for president? 100%? My response was, "Absolutely, 100%, cross my heart. Is there a stack of Bibles somewhere?" Look, maybe it's only 99%. I care a lot about working families. I care a lot about the collapse of the American middle class. I care a lot about the enormous wealth and income disparity in our country. I care a lot that poverty in America is near an all-time high, but hardly anyone talks about it. I realize running for president would be a way to shine a spotlight on these issues that are too often in the shadows today, but I am at least 99% sure I won't. How did I go from being 99% sure that I would not run for president in October 2013 to standing before a crowd of 5,000 on May 26, 2015 in Burlington, Vermont, declaring my candidacy? There were four basic reasons. First, did it make sense that Hillary Clinton, the centrist candidate of the Democratic establishment, be anointed as the Democratic nominee and be allowed to run without opposition? Was that good for democracy? Was that good for the Democratic Party? Was it good for the progressive movement? At that time, very early in the campaign season, it was also assumed that Jeb Bush, the son of President George H.W. Bush and the brother of President George W. Bush, would be the likely Republican candidate for president. What was going on in our country? Was there really going to be an election between the son and brother of former presidents and the wife of a former president? Talk about oligarchy. Talk about political dynasties. That was not what I wanted to see. That was not what most Americans wanted to see. Hillary Rodham Clinton and I were not best friends, but I had known her for 25 years, liked her, and respected her. I first met her in 1993 when she became First Lady and I was a member of Congress. I got to know her better when we served together in the Senate from 2006 to 2008. During the Clinton administration, I was impressed by her willingness to break the mold of what a First Lady was supposed to do. She became the administration's leader on health care reform, one of the major, most controversial issues of the day. In that role, she took a lot of abuse, much of it unjustified. Above and beyond the normal criticism that goes with differences of opinion in any policy debate, it was clear that many of the Republican attacks against her were sexist. She was a woman. She was the First Lady. Why was she leading the effort to transform our nation's entire healthcare system? Weren't there other more ladylike things for her to do? Throughout my entire political career, I have been an advocate for a Medicare for All single-payer program. That approach is simpler, more comprehensive, and far more cost-effective than the reforms advocated by mainstream politicians, including Hillary Clinton. My view is, and has always been, that healthcare is a right of all people, and that the United States should join the rest of the industrialized world in guaranteeing that right. The approach taken by the Clinton administration, led by Hillary Clinton, was very different. Their plan called for combining the private healthcare system with a significantly increased government presence. The result was something that was enormously complicated, which was one of the reasons that led to its downfall. While there may not have been many Americans or members of Congress who fully understood the healthcare system that the Clinton administration was advocating, one thing was very sure. Hillary Clinton did. She was not some kind of figurehead in leading the administration's healthcare effort. For better or worse, she helped design the plan and knew it inside out. She was deeply in the weeds in a plan that was overgrown with weeds. In December 1993, Hillary gave a speech on healthcare reform to the Dartmouth Medical School in Hanover, New Hampshire. I was invited to attend the speech and, given that Hanover is across the river from Vermont, was able to hitch a ride with the First Lady on the Air Force II plane that took her there. On the plane trip, she and I had a pleasant discussion about healthcare and other issues. What impressed me most about Clinton's speech at Dartmouth was not what she said. I disagreed with a lot that was in the Clinton healthcare reform package. It was how she said it. For over an hour, without notes, she went through detail after detail of that enormously complicated plan. She knew that plan backward and forward. She also answered questions flawlessly. 25 years later, I still marvel at that performance. Further, ask Barack Obama about her abilities as a debater. In 2008, she and Obama went up against each other in some 25 debates. I think the president would be the first to admit that she won most of them. No one should doubt Hillary Clinton's intelligence. While I respected her and liked her as a person, we had very strong differences of opinion, not only with regard to policy, but in our basic political approaches. Hillary Clinton was a key player in the centrist Democratic establishment which had, over the years, been forged by her husband, Bill Clinton. In fact, Bill Clinton had been the head of the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, a conservative Democratic organization funded by big money interests, which was described by Jesse Jackson as Democrats for the leisure class. The Clinton approach was to try to merge the interests of Wall Street and corporate America with the needs of the American middle class, an impossible task. While the Clinton administration can boast of some positive accomplishments, and I supported Bill Clinton in his two campaigns, there were some major policy failures during his presidency directly related to his alliances with big money interests. These failures caused a lot of pain for many Americans. These were policies that Hillary Clinton supported. The Clinton administration worked closely with Wall Street and Republicans to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act and deregulate the major financial institutions in the country. This initiative, pushed by Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, a top Wall Street executive, unleashed the greed of the major financial institutions and their contempt for the law. It allowed large commercial banks to merge with investment banks and insurance companies. In my view, and in the view of many financial experts, that decision led to the 2008 Wall Street crash and the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression of 1929. A Democratic president should not be in bed with Wall Street. It was not only Wall Street deregulation that the Clinton administration pushed. They also worked with corporate America and against the trade union movement and a majority of Democrats in pushing through NAFTA, a disastrous trade agreement that not only cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs, but laid the groundwork for future free trade deals that were equally disastrous. On social issues, Clinton in 1996 signed the Homophobic Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. Hillary Clinton defended that decision for years and was very late in getting on board with marriage equality. The Clinton administration, with Hillary's support, also pushed so-called welfare reform and mass incarceration policies. My disagreements with the Clintons' centrist approach were based not only on policy, as important as that was, but on politics, how you bring about real change in the country. What kind of party should the Democratic Party be? The Clintons over the years received huge amounts of money in campaign contributions and speaking fees from powerful financial interests and corporate America. Whether it was on the campaign trail or in their private lives, they spent an enormous amount of time raising money from the wealthy and the powerful. In fact, in some circles, they became known as Clinton Incorporated. To me, a very basic political principle is that you cannot take on the establishment when you take their money. It is simply not credible to believe that candidates receive significant amounts of financial support from some of the most powerful special interests in the world would make decisions that would negatively impact the bottom lines of those donors. The only way to bring about real change is to mobilize millions of people at the grassroots level against the establishment, against the big money interest. I also worried about Hillary Clinton's approach to foreign policy. As a senator, she had supported President Bush and voted for the war in Iraq, one of the worst foreign policy blunders in the history of the United States. As Secretary of State, she had supported a number of initiatives, including policies in Libya and Syria, which were too hawkish from my point of view. While very few debate the right of Israel to exist in peace and security, I thought she did not pay enough attention to the suffering of the Palestinian people. For me, the bottom line was that this country was facing enormous crises, the continued decline of the middle class, a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, high rates of real unemployment, a disastrous trade policy, an inadequate educational system, and a collapsing infrastructure. On top of all that, we needed bold action to combat climate change and make certain that this planet was healthy and habitable for our children and grandchildren. Politically, we were facing a corrupt campaign finance system where billionaires were able to buy elections. More and more people were becoming demoralized, and low-income and young people were not voting. did I believe that the same old establishment politics and establishment economics, as represented by Hillary Clinton, could effectively address these crises? No, I didn't. A presidential campaign is a unique opportunity to raise issues and force debate on perspectives that are often ignored by the establishment and the media. Should that once in 4 years opportunity be ignored? Should Hillary Clinton be allowed to get the Democratic nomination without having to defend her views against a progressive perspective? The answer was no. There were too many issues out there that had to see the light of day, and it would be wrong to squander the opportunity that is available in a presidential campaign. Second, if I didn't run, who else would? Elizabeth Warren, the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, is a good friend of mine and an outstanding member of Congress. Years before she became a senator, when she taught at Harvard Law School, she joined me for town meetings in Vermont, where she did a remarkable job in conveying complicated economic concepts in a language that everyone could understand. She is a strong and progressive leader in the Senate, opposing Wall Street malfeasance and tackling many other formidable issues. There was a lot of discussion within liberal circles and in the media regarding the possibility of Elizabeth running for president. In fact, there was even a well-funded and well-publicized effort to draft Senator Warren that included paid organizers in various states around the country. A widely circulated letter from the Ready for Warren campaign captured what many Americans were feeling about the need for opposition to Hillary Clinton. And this is what it said. We are ready for Warren. We are Americans of all stripes calling for a leader who's fighting on our side for a change. We are progressives ready to support someone who isn't afraid to take on powerful interests like the Wall Street banks that crashed our economy. We are students in New Hampshire worried about how we'll make it after racking up thousands of dollars in debt to get an education. Moms in Iowa struggling to raise families while costs go up each day, but paychecks don't keep pace. We aren't wealthy or well-connected. We don't have any lobbyists. What we are is a movement of individuals working together who believe that folks like us should have a greater say in the direction of our country. It was clear that millions of Americans wanted to see a serious primary campaign in which a progressive vision would be matched against Secretary Clinton's more moderate views. Liberal organizations like Democracy for America, DFA, and MoveOn.org were mobilizing grassroots support for a candidate they could back in the nomination process. In her public utterances, Senator Warren and her staff were clear and consistent in stating that she would not run. In the private conversations that we had, she also gave no indication that she intended to run for president. What other possible candidates were out there who could credibly run a progressive campaign against Clinton? Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland and mayor of Baltimore, was making it clear that he was interested in running. While he was an intelligent and effective governor, it didn't seem likely that he could capture much progressive support. Nor could my friend and the former U.S. Senator from Virginia, Jim Webb, former Rhode Island governor and Senator Lincoln Chafee, also indicated an interest in running. Was there a better potential progressive candidate out there than me? Probably not. I was a U.S. Senator, a former congressman, and a former mayor. I had won my last election with 71% of the vote. I had real policy achievements and years of political experience. I had met with foreign government leaders throughout the world. While I was far from a household name nationally, I was known by millions of people. My Senate Facebook was one of the most popular in Congress with more than a million friends, and I had given more than a few speeches around the country. But to put things in perspective, the American people were not exactly clamoring for a Sanders candidacy, even among the most progressive circles in the country. As the Rutland Herald reported in April 2014, quote, in an online survey of more than 100,000 MoveOn.org members taken earlier this year, Sanders was the third most popular choice among named candidates with 6%, following Clinton with 32% and Warren with 15%, end of quote. And that was among progressives. Third, I did not have to make a definitive decision right away. There was plenty of time to, quote, test the waters, and determine if there really was the kind of interest and support necessary to run a serious campaign. What did I have to lose by letting people know that I was thinking about running? Jane and those politically close to me reasoned that at worst, floating a balloon would give me the opportunity to get some public attention on issues I felt strongly about, issues like income and wealth inequality, the declining middle class, climate change, a corrupt campaign finance system, etc. The national media is much more interested in what a possible presidential candidate has to say than it is in the words of a plain old senator. If we found that our efforts were generating excitement, support, and commitment, we could go forward and begin the campaign. If not, we could pull the plug and not run. What was wrong with that? At a speech I gave in New Hampshire in October 2014, someone in the audience said, and I quote, "Senator, I'm a lifelong Democrat, an avid Democrat, but I think that the current environment is so bad that our Democrats who are running for president will not talk about these issues. They bought into the system enough that they are part of the system. If you don't run for president, we won't be discussing these issues on a national level the way we should be doing. Will you do that for us?" End of quote. 7 days, a Vermont publication reported. To that, the previously quiet audience burst into applause, and someone standing in the back of the hall let out a loud whoop. I've been going around the country and talking to a lot of working class audiences, and people are angry, an unsmiling Sanders responded. People know that the deck is stacked against them. People want real change. They want these issues not only discussed, they want policies to represent them and not just the 1%. So for that reason, in fact, I am giving thought. I'm giving thought, he continued. I haven't made that decision yet, but if I do it, I want to do it well, not just for me, but for you. Fourth, I had talked for years about the need to take my politics outside of Vermont and outside of Capitol Hill. Over and over again, I had expressed the view that Vermont was not some kind of isolated fortress for progressive ideas, and that if properly presented, there was a nationwide audience that would be receptive to the views we held. I was especially curious as to how these ideas would play in other rural states, states that Democrats often did poorly in. In Vermont, we win support not just from, quote, activists. Our ideas resonate with ordinary working class and middle class voters. Would that be true elsewhere? Could we break through in parts of the country that rarely hear a progressive perspective but are saturated with Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and other right-wing propaganda? How would I or anyone else ever know if we didn't try? Further, as chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs and a member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, getting around the country would give me an opportunity to see with my own eyes some of the issues that we discussed abstractly every day in committee or on the floor of the Senate. I could visit in a non-political capacity VA facilities and those people on the front lines in education, healthcare, housing, and other areas I had long been concerned about. What was the problem with traveling to parts of the country I had never seen and learning from people I would otherwise never meet? If I expressed interest in running for president, a question that would be asked of me immediately was whether I would be running as an independent or within the Democratic primary process. Given the fact that I was the longest-serving independent in the history of the U.S. Congress, it would not have been an unreasonable question. The truth is, there were pluses and minuses to both approaches. The honest answer to that question would have been, let's hear what our supporters have to say. What did they think? It wasn't a decision we could make in a political vacuum. Testing the waters. In presidential politics, you really hit the campaign trail before you hit the campaign trail. It's called, quote, testing the waters, determining whether there is the kind of support in the real world that you'll need to run a successful campaign. Well before I was formally a candidate for president, when I was still just thinking about it, My longtime Vermont friend and co-worker Phil Fremonti and I did some traveling around the country. We wanted to get a sense of what kind of support there was for our ideas and whether running for president made any sense. I know. That's what candidates who intend to run for office always say. But in our case, it was true. If there was real support, if it looked like we could run a credible campaign, we would do it. If not, no big deal. I was proud of being a senator from Vermont. There are worse jobs in the world. As is the Vermont way, our trips were pretty low-key. No entourage, no advance people, no communications director, no security, just Phil and me flying in coach, renting cars, and showing up for meetings, trying to get a sense of the potential support that might exist. I have always believed that the Democratic Party must be a 50-state party. This was an idea forcefully articulated by my fellow Vermonter, former Governor Howard Dean, when he was chairman of the DNC, and he was right. The Democrats do well in the East, they do well in the West, they do well in a number of Midwestern states. But there were entire regions of the country, including the Deep South and rural America, where the party was extremely weak, had almost no organization, and was unable to run serious candidates for statewide office. While it is not likely the Democrats will start winning statewide elections tomorrow in Alabama, South Carolina, Kansas, Wyoming, or Utah, they will never win if they don't plant the flag and start organizing. My own state of Vermont is a good example. 45 years ago, Vermont was one of the most Republican states in the country. Today, as a result of a lot of hard work by many people, it is one of the most progressive. It is inconceivable that a serious national party would surrender dozens of states in this country to right-wing Republicans, including some of the poorest states in the country. But that is exactly what the Democrats are doing.